2. Christendom. The Christian Mission. Christendom and Christianization. The early Middle Ages recognized Christianity, faith, and Christians, believers, but had no geographic concept of Christendom. Faith began with baptism, christening. The role of kings, lords, and bishops was to oversee this, and to enforce observance of holy days and other outward markers of inner belief. The slogan, Defense of Christendom, Defensio Christianitatis, emerged during the 9th century in response to the Muslim-Arab threat, especially in southern Europe, and it identified the wider lay community beyond the church, Ecclesia, which the emperor should defend. Christendom only assumed closer associations with Europe through Gregory VII's promotion of the papacy as sole and exclusive leader of all Christians, reducing the emperor to being mere ruler of the largest Christian kingdom. The geographic demarcation was consolidated by the First Crusade of 1095 and those that followed, which involved military expeditions against what was regarded as an Eastern other. The empire's southern reaches encompassed Italy, including Rome, into the 11th century. The absence of a religious boundary in the West contributed to the lack of clear demarcation between the empire and what became France. Differences were sharper with the pagan Scandinavians, Slavs, and Magyars to the north and east. An extensive belt of pagan peoples across southeast Europe separated the empire from its Christian counterpart in Byzantium, a major factor in the ability of both empires to ignore each other. Thus, though geographically located in the heart of what is now considered Europe, the empire lay on the northern and eastern edges of Latin Christianity, and provided the principal means by which that faith penetrated these regions. A sense of East-West distinctions was already present in the inhabitants' myths of origins. The Franks considered themselves descendants of Noah's son Japheth, and thought the Slavs stemmed from another of Noah's sons, Ham. The Slavs worshipped forest and sky gods, practiced bigamy, cremation, and other customs totally alien to Christians, such as digging their houses into the ground, in contrast to the wooden post construction used by the Franks. Slavs had little affinity for Christian practices and regarded tithes as tribute to an alien, unwanted god. Even those willing to embrace Christianity encountered significant cultural barriers. The boundaries between past and present in Slavic culture were more fluid than among Christians accustomed to the Bible's linear chronology. The refusal of Christian priests to baptize ancestors made no sense to Slavs. Christianization aided the consolidation of imperial authority and promoted its extension north and eastwards across the river Elbe. However, unlike the Muslim Ottomans, who would form a majority in their own empire only late in the 19th century, the empire's population was always overwhelmingly Christian, with only a small Jewish minority. The population included relatively few pagan Slavs in the ambiguous border zones of the northeast, who were largely Christianized by the 13th century. Christianization was not a clash of civilizations. This popular yet controversial approach defines civilization largely through religion and regards cultures as mutually exclusive, homogeneous entities that either clash or engage in dialogue. The empire's expansion was certainly legitimated in language which later generations would consider that of civilization overcoming barbarianism. Religious texts and laws certainly distinguished Christians from Slavs, Jews, and Muslims. However, culture offers a repertoire of behavior, experience, and attitudes allowing individuals to select what is meaningful or useful in their own context. Interactions depend on circumstances. Boundaries are blurred by negotiation, exchange, and integration, and contact is rarely exclusively either benign or violent. Christianity underwent considerable changes in practice and belief throughout this period, What was considered acceptable at one point could be condemned later. The sense of a fully defined Christendom only assumed its true shape as a singular, exclusive civilization in the period of romantic nostalgia following the French and Industrial Revolutions. Motives. It is unlikely that Charlemagne and the Franks had a conscious policy to create a single populus Christianus. The principal sources for this view are clerics, who put their own gloss on Carolingian actions. Carolingian society was primarily organized for war, not prayer. Its goal was to acquire wealth through plunder and extorting tribute, and to translate claims to authority into reality by gaining prestige, reputation, and dominion. Christianity channeled these ambitions by identifying non-Christians as legitimate targets. Crucially, the empire's foundation coincided with the revival of the Western European slave trade, which had declined with the demise of ancient Rome and the development of a servile rural population working the land. Demand for slaves returned with the rise of the Arabs, their growing wealth, and their switch from tribal to slave armies. The Vikings emerged to service this economy by seizing captives in northern and western Europe for sale in the Mediterranean. The Carolingians and Ottonians provided a second supply through their campaigns across the Elbe. The word slave is cognate with Slav and began to displace the earlier Latin term servus during this period. Meanwhile, both the Saxons and Slavs engaged in more localized raiding for women. These practices only ceased with a general growth in population and the assimilation of East Elbian areas into the empire around 1200. There were other reasons for laity to answer the clergy's call to spread the gospel. The empire's elite was uniformly Christian and shared a concern for salvation and the belief that God influenced earthly events. The idea of penance was powerfully attractive to a warrior elite engaged in killing, fitted with Germanic legal customs that demanded reparations for victims, and encouraged lavish endowments of material resources to the church. The development of indulgences at the end of the 11th century allowed warriors to gain remission from sin by serving in the Crusades. Endowments were additionally encouraged by the belief in vicarious merit, in which prayers and intercessions by the living benefited the donor's soul long after their death. These beliefs, in turn, encouraged the laity's concern for monastic discipline and good ecclesiastical management, since a community of lax and negligent monks was a poor investment. Endowments removed wealth from the grasp of rivals and entrusted it to a transpersonal institution headed by Christ. The clergy enjoyed considerable social prestige through their proximity to God and their role as transmitters of written culture. The church offered a secure and attractive career for those of the elite who did not fit into the secular world, either because they were surplus to requirements as younger sons or unmarried daughters, or through personal misfortune. Hermann the Lame probably had cerebral palsy and, unable to train as a warrior like his brothers, was placed instead in Reichenau Abbey, where he could develop his prodigious literary and musical talents. Religious houses were also secure places to confine wayward relatives and rivals. Spiritual goals. Thus, Christianization was driven by a powerful mix of conviction and self-interest. The objective was outward conformity and submission. In contrast to Byzantium, before the 12th century, the Western Church did not inquire too deeply into what people believed. Conversion and winning souls entailed persuading powerful local figures to join the clergy or enter a monastery. The captured sons of Slav nobles were often educated by monks in the 9th and 10th centuries. Later, as Christians, these Slavs used their personal connections to advance conversion among their own people by acting as baptismal sponsors. The Carolingians and Ottonians were likewise quite successful in persuading Viking warlords to convert, thereby assimilating barbarians in the same way as did the ancient Roman Empire. Carolingian kings were already coordinating these activities before 800. A series of church synods between 780 and 820 increased the incentives for lay patronage through written guidelines, capitulares, to improve monastic discipline. Monks and nuns were distinguished by their vows and strictly circumscribed lives, setting them apart from secular canons and canonesses who lived a communal life and acted as political and economic managers of church assets. While the first group prayed for benefactors, the second provided suitable roles for noble sons and daughters. The synods ensured clergy had the tools of their trade. 8th and 9th century inventories show that most of the empire's churches contained at least one religious book, a remarkable achievement in an age without printing. The Christian message was also conveyed through non-written methods, like wall paintings, sculptures, sermons, and mystery plays. Objectives remained realistic. Bishops were to ensure liturgical uniformity and check that lesser clergy preached on Sundays and holy days, visited the sick, and performed baptisms and burials. Burial rites were an important marker of Christianity, displacing earlier customs of interring horses and weapons in warrior graves. However, saints' days only became regular calendar fixtures in the 12th century, while it was not until 1215 that confession became at least an annual obligation. Considerable scope remained for local toleration of pagan practices and heterodoxy, all of which eased assimilation. Missionaries. Christianization varied across the empire. The church had enjoyed support from local elites in Burgundy and Italy since late antiquity, in contrast to Britain, where Christianity had largely expired by the late 6th century and had to be reintroduced by missionaries. Meanwhile, much of Germany had escaped both Romanization and Christianization. Frankish influence remained limited to the Rhine-Main nexus prior to the rapid conquest of Alemannia, Bavaria, and Saxony, completed by Charlemagne around 800. For most of what became the Kingdom of Germany, conquest and Christianization proceeded together, and the entire church structure had to be created from scratch. The new German church was both a national, i.e. general, and local institution, owing its overall shape to royal initiative, but its specific character to lords and missionaries on the ground. Frankish kings sent missionaries to Frisia on the North Sea coast from the 690s, and others into central and northern Germany to work among the heathen Saxons from 718. Saint Boniface, the most famous of these missionaries, felled the sacred oak at Geismar in Thuringia to prove the impotence of pagan gods. A major push followed between 775 and 777, when around 70 priests and deacons traveled to northwest Germany, including Willehard, who became the first North German bishop in 787. Ludger was a prominent yet fairly typical missionary. A third-generation Christian Anglo-Saxon, he had been educated in Utrecht and York, imbibing the literate, cosmopolitan culture characteristic of a period without clear political or national boundaries. He worked among the Frisians from 787, moving his base in 793 to Mimigernaford, an important ford and crossroads, where he established a monasterium, giving the later name of Munster to the settlement that slowly developed around it. Like Boniface's felling of the sacred oak, military victories were intended to prove that God favored only Christians. Acceptance of the conqueror's religion was a powerful sign of submission, hence the significance attached to the baptism of the Saxon leader Widukind in 785. Germanic warrior culture provided common ground, easing assimilation. The Saxon elite embraced Christianity within two generations. Already in 845, the Saxon Count Ludolf and his wife Oda traveled to Rome to fetch relics and papal approval for a convent at Gandersheim. 5 years later, Widukind's grandson, Walbert, collected Roman relics for his own monastery at Wildeshausen. Christianization and imperial expansion both slowed as the Carolingian civil wars coincided with intensified external raids by Vikings, Arabs, and Magyars during the middle and later 9th century. The stabilization of the northern and eastern frontiers allowed renewed activity from the early 930s. The king and his cleric advisors selected suitable monks who were sent to Rome to secure papal backing and holy relics before being dispatched to establish new churches and persuade local pagans to convert. In time, these churches were placed on a firmer footing through incorporation within new or existing dioceses. A notable example was the mission of Abbot Hadomir of Fulda in 947, which revived Willehard's archbishopric of Hamburg-Bremen as the primary center for the Christianization of Scandinavia and the Baltic. The emperor was rarely able to help missionaries once they set off into the wild north and east. Those sent to Denmark were expelled in the 820s, and Christianization made no headway there until the conversion of Harald Bluetooth in the mid-10th century. The cooperation of local elites proved indispensable, especially as conversion entailed simultaneous acceptance of imperial suzerainty and payment of tithes. The Bohemian leader and later saint, Wenceslas, had been educated as a Christian and accepted imperial overlordship, only to be murdered on his brother's orders in 929. Bohemia was forced to acknowledge imperial suzerainty in 950, though resistance to Christianity persisted into the 11th century. Nonetheless, conversion of much of its elite proved significant in spreading Christianity and imperial influence to the East Elbian Slavs and to the Poles and Magyars. Wojtek Adalbert, a missionary martyred by the Prussians in 997, came from the Bohemian ruling family. Despite the impressive scope of its activity, Ottonian Christianization rested on insecure foundations, with few churches and only a tenuous hold on most of the East Elbian and Baltic populations. Its vulnerability was exposed during the massive Slav rising of July 983, which, in turn, was probably encouraged by Otto II's catastrophic defeat by the Arabs at Cotrone the previous year. Churches and castles were swept away, leaving the partially Christianized Sorbs around Meissen as a last outpost. The other East Elbian bishoprics remained only nominally in existence, and it was not until the 12th century that the bishops of Brandenburg and Havelberg could visit their dioceses. Nonetheless, many Slavs found Christianity attractive, especially the elite, who saw it as a way to enhance their own status through association with Latin culture and power. Bohemian and Polish nobles had already converted before 983 and refused to join the revolt. The Polish Duke, Boleslav I Chrobry, the Brave, ransomed Wojtek's body from the Prussians and placed it in his capital at Gniezno, just prior to Otto III's pilgrimage during Lent 1000. The emperor's visit resulted in Gniezno's elevation to an archbishopric, with jurisdiction over missionary bishops in Krakow, Kolberg, and Breslau, Wroclaw. This entailed the transfer of jurisdictions that were previously part of the Magdeburg and Hamburg-Bremen archdioceses, as well as recognition of Boleslav Chrobry as an allied, if still subordinate, prince, sharing in the imperial Christianizing mission. Cooperation was symbolized by Otto's gift of a copy of the Holy Lance in exchange for the prized relic of Wojtek's arm. Boleslav was clearly elevated above his local rivals, while the establishment of a separate Polish ecclesiastical structure provided the basis for that country as an independent monarchy. Polish Christianity was swept away by a pagan rising between 1037 and 1039, during which the rest of Wojtek's corpse was retrieved and installed in Prague, where it became the focus of a cult extending across Germany, Bohemia, Poland, and Hungary. Polish Christianity was rebuilt through new monastic foundations in the later 11th century. Building the German Church. Burgundy and Italy already had established ecclesiastical structures dating from late antiquity, when dioceses had been established on the framework provided by the Roman imperial provinces. The emperor's primary contribution to the development of the Italian Church was to encourage the Pope to create new institutions in southern Italy to curb Byzantine influence during the late 10th century. These factors ensured there were 26 archdioceses in Italy in 1000, compared to 6 in Burgundy, 7 in France, 2 in Britain, and 1 each in Poland and Hungary. The general framework for the German Church was laid out in just 20 years by Charlemagne in collaboration with the Pope. Already an important base during St. Boniface's mission, Mainz was elevated to an archdiocese in 780 to oversee all missionary work east of the Rhine. The rapidity of subsequent conquests necessitated more subdivisions to allow closer supervision of the population being incorporated into the Frankish realm. Cologne was raised to an archbishopric in 794, with responsibility for northwest Germany and the Frisian missions. Hamburg-Bremen was initially one of its subordinate bishoprics, but was itself raised to archiepiscopal status during the 860s, with responsibility for lands beyond the Elbe. Bavaria's submission to Carolingian rule led to Salzburg's elevation as an archbishopric in 798. The empire's foundation in 800 was preceded the year before by an assembly held by Charlemagne and Leo III in Paderborn, which had served as the main military and missionary base in the campaigns against the Saxons since 770. It was agreed to leave Saxony as part of the Archdiocese of Mainz, which was simultaneously confirmed as Germany's premier archbishopric. Trier was raised to an archdiocese around 800, with jurisdiction over what became Lorraine, a factor in this province's eventual attachment to Germany rather than France. Besançon was meanwhile made the senior archdiocese for Burgundy. Complete by 800, this basic framework survived a millennium. The only major modification was made by Otto I, and the difficulties he encountered amply illustrate the role of local elites in developing the imperial church. Otto wanted to commemorate his victory at Lechfeld over the Magyars in 955, and improve coordination of missionary activity beyond the Elbe. At his imperial coronation in 962, he announced the establishment of a new archbishopric based at Magdeburg, equal in status to Mainz, which was expected to relinquish its jurisdiction over the Saxons. The bishoprics of Brandenburg and Havelberg were transferred from Mainz. The bishop of Halberstadt, also under Mainz, was required to surrender part of his diocese to create a new bishopric of Merseburg, while additional bishops were to be installed at Meissen and Zeitz in the missionary areas. Implementation was delayed until 968 by opposition from Otto's son, Archbishop Wilhelm of Mainz. Otto I's death in 973 opened the way to reverse his pet project. The Pope adjusted the German hierarchy in 975 to 976, reasserting Mainz's premiership and extending it to include Bohemia's bishopric, created in Prague in 973. Otto II used the death of the first Archbishop of Magdeburg in 981 as an opportunity to suppress the bishopric of Merseburg and redistribute its resources and jurisdictions to Halberstadt, Zeitz, and Meissen, which were all considered underendowed. Giselher, the former Merseburg bishop, was compensated by promotion to the vacant see of Magdeburg. However, this still left lesser clergy deeply disgruntled, including Tietmar, a Merseburg cathedral canon, who interpreted the 983 Slav Rising as divine punishment for the suppression of his beloved diocese. Even the imperial family were divided over the issue. Otto's second wife, Theophanu, supported Dietmar, while the emperor's mother, Adelheid, backed Archbishop Giselher in opposing Merseburg's restoration. The imperial women intervened because Merseburg's dissolution affected the jurisdiction over convents under their patronage. Otto III ordered Merseburg's restoration in 998, but this was only achieved when Giselher died 6 years later, and the new king Henry II made a large donation to compensate Magdeburg and Halberstadt. No further archdioceses were added after Magdeburg, but the number of bishoprics grew through a subdivision of existing dioceses and the creation of new ones as the empire expanded eastwards again from the 12th century. Charlemagne's realm had contained 180 bishoprics, of which 45 were under direct papal control. A significant number were detached in the empire's partition in 843, following the Treaty of Verdun, but the development of the German Church created 32 bishoprics and 6 archbishoprics there by 973. This total grew to over 50 by 1500, or around a tenth of all those in Latin Christendom. There were another 9 that remained unincorporated within an archdiocese, as well as 5 more outside all archiepiscopal control, because they had been placed under direct papal supervision, like Bamberg, founded by Henry II in 1024. Abbeys. The 8th century already saw the foundation of abbeys as a third ecclesiastical tier, junior to bishoprics and archbishoprics. Abbeys had smaller jurisdictions and were initially closer than diocesan centers to the monastic ideal of prayer. Frankish conquests both created the need for a local ecclesiastical infrastructure and secured the slave labor necessary to build it. Charlemagne is credited with founding 27 cathedrals and 232 monasteries and abbeys, compared to 65 palaces. This activity created a new sacral landscape in Germany, where only Mainz, Cologne, and Trier had relatively old churches. Some important monasteries traced their origins to early missionary churches, like St. Gallen, established in Switzerland by an Irish monk in 612, though the actual church dated from the 830s. Association with a martyred missionary often influenced the choice of location, but royal or lordly initiative was important too. Patronage of churches and abbeys helped preserve lordly family identity. The Ottonians traced their origins to Ludolf and Oda, the pious founders of Gandersheim Convent. In praying for them, the Gandersheim nuns helped perpetuate the Ottonians' memoria, including Abbess Hrotswith, who wrote an early family history. Moreover, the Ottonians broke even more sharply than the Carolingians with the old Frankish practice of partible inheritance, thereby increasing the need for suitable accommodation for younger or unmarried children excluded from inheritance. All Gandersheim's early abbesses, including Hrotswith, were Ludolf and Oda's direct descendants. Patronage extended to multiple sites, especially amongst the royal family, which remained without a fixed capital into the later Middle Ages and needed staging posts for their journeys around the empire. Extended kinship continued to outweigh patrilinear descent in family structure, also encouraging the use of different places. In addition to Gandersheim, for instance, the Ottonians developed the former Carolingian castle of Quedlingburg into another important family convent, promoted by Henry I's widow, Matilda. Matilda held the status of canoness regular, created by the earlier Carolingian legislation, allowing her to become Quedlingburg's first rector without taking vows as a nun. The Imperial Church. This ecclesiastical infrastructure emerged as the empire developed creating what became known as the Imperial Church and serving as a primary pillar of the political order into the early 19th century. As a new foundation, the Imperial Church rested on recently endowed land, most of which came directly from the emperor. The Franks had donated about a third of their land to the church between the 5th and 8th centuries, but Charles Martel had secularized much of this to fund his campaigns. Donations resumed under his grandson, Charlemagne, but were most extensive in the newly conquered areas east of the Rhine, where property could be redistributed from defeated peoples. Prüm Abbey, north of Trier, was especially favored, acquiring 1,700 individual properties scattered across Lotharingia, inhabited by 16,000 to 20,000 people in 893. The 12 manors belonging to Saint-Bertin Abbey in 9th century Flanders encompassed 11,000 hectares, while Nivelles Abbey near Ghent had 14,000 dependent farms when it was given by Otto II to Theophanu after their marriage in 972. These properties were gifted as benefices, remaining ultimately royal possessions whilst used by the beneficiaries. The Carolingians also finally achieved the long-standing Merovingian goal of enforcing the tithe as a one-tenth tax on all Christians. Bishops were charged with coordinating collection, but the role of assigning tithes to specific churches often lay with the king. The emperor expected a significant return on his investment. Senior clergy represented a readily identifiable group of vassals who could be summoned, in contrast to the much larger and fluctuating numbers of secular lords. The advice of clerics was valued, especially as they were usually literate, well-traveled, and widely connected. They could draw on their substantial endowments to supply troops for royal campaigns and coronation journeys. These burdens increased at the end of the 10th century, when German kings largely stopped living in palaces and instead stayed with bishops and abbots as they taught the empire. Clerics critical of such displays compared royal visits with biblical plagues of locusts. However, the imperial church was never an exclusive instrument of royal dominion, since lesser lords were also partners in these arrangements. This point is important, since it explains why the imperial church became so deeply embedded in the empire's socio-political hierarchy. Secular lords were already important local donors before the 9th century civil wars disrupted royal supervision of abbeys. Losch, Fulda, and other important imperial abbeys acquired additional local patrons. Some houses slipped entirely under local control. Others were founded by lords on their own land. These trends created a second mediate ecclesiastical layer under lordly jurisdiction and only indirectly subject to imperial authority. Carolingian lords passed monasteries directly to their sons, and lordly control remained pronounced until revised as protectorate powers during the investiture dispute that began in the 1070s. Prior to Gregory VII, lordly influence was generally welcomed. The early missionaries faced a monumental task and needed lordly protection and assistance. The term parish, parochium, and priest, sacerdos, still meant diocese and bishop respectively until well into the 11th century. Clergy remained based in the primary religious sites like cathedral towns, traveling to outlying oratories and churches to perform services. Missionary activity further promoted the incipient hierarchy through founding mother-daughter networks with satellite churches surrounding their abbeys. Further church building allowed the initially large parishes to be subdivided. By the 11th century, most dioceses contained sufficient numbers of parishes to require an intermediary level of deaconries to supervise them. Demarcation was often driven by the desire to define control over tithes and other resources. Clergy also responded to growing demands for their services from the 10th century, as well as new ideas emerging from Gregorian reform and the requirement after 1215 to confess annually. The parish churches envisaged in Carolingian legislation around 800 finally became reality in the later Middle Ages, when there were 50,000 parishes in the empire, compared to 9,000 in England and a total of 160,000 across Latin Europe. The impact was profound. Christianity extended beyond the elite to become a more genuinely popular religion, changing many of its practices in the process. The incorporation or assignment of a parish to an abbey, a deaconry, or other higher jurisdiction entailed control over its resources, including tithes and any endowments associated with its church. With this often came the power to appoint the parish priest. By 1500, half of German parishes had been incorporated in this way, often with the priest's functions entrusted to poorly paid vicars as substitutes. This formed a major grievance, fueling what would become the Reformation. But it also illustrates the growing complexity of overlapping jurisdictions and interconnected spiritual, economic, and political interests in the empire. These local networks remained mediate, subject to one or more intervening levels of secular supervision below the emperor's overall authority, as well as subordination to at least one layer of spiritual authority, such as that of an abbot or a bishop. The extensive lordly influence remained acceptable to the emperor because he retained overall supervision of the imperial church, including the appointment of archbishops, bishops, and many abbots who remained his immediate vassals on account of their benefices. There was no significant breach in this control until 1198, when the secular supervision of the bishopric of Prague was transferred to the Bohemian king. The Bohemian church acquired full autonomy in 1344, when Prague was raised to an archbishopric, freeing it from Mainz's spiritual jurisdiction. A separate Habsburg territorial church followed Frederick III's concordat with the Pope in 1448, which was consolidated with the establishment of new bishoprics in Vienna and Wiener Neustadt in 1469, subject to Frederick's jurisdiction as Austrian Archduke rather than as Emperor. However, both bishoprics would remain under the spiritual jurisdiction of the Archbishop of Salzburg, despite some reduction of that cleric's powers by Joseph II in the 1780s. The Imperial Church System. Before exploring the impact of the Reformation, we need to turn from the Imperial Church's structure to its place in medieval imperial politics. The monarch's influence over senior clerical appointments was a key royal prerogative that assumed even greater significance with the Ottonian kings after 919. Despite widespread clerical concubinage, the senior clergy were still celibate and lived under rules distinguishing them from the laity. As such, they could not pass their benefices directly to sons or relations, and so did not exhibit the trend to hereditary possession that was a constant feature of secular jurisdictions in the empire. Consequently, the Ottonians saw the senior clergy as potentially more reliable partners than the great secular lords. Growing reliance on the imperial clergy changed the episcopate from the cosmopolitan learned monks of the Carolingian era to a more aristocratic, politically engaged group, and created what has been termed the imperial church system, Reichskirchensystem. This label remains useful, provided we remember that the political use of the imperial church was never a coherent policy. Much depended on circumstances and personalities. Kings had to respect local interests, not simply through the formal requirements of canon law, but because ignoring these usually caused trouble. Two-thirds of 11th century bishops were either born in their see or had served there prior to appointment. Bishops married their church, displaying a sense of transpersonal office by the 11th century, and seeking to raise their see's prestige through cathedral building, relic collecting, and territorial acquisitions. Simultaneously, the old ideal of the monk-like bishop was displaced around 1050 by a new model of the energetic shepherd actively promoting his flock's welfare. The itinerant royal chapel was central to the king's influence. Established under the Carolingians to provide religious services at court, it was developed by Otto I from the 950s to test the loyalty of his secular vassals by encouraging them to send their sons there to be educated. Soon, those who showed promise were rewarded with the next vacant bishopric or abbey. Turnover was relatively high, offering numerous opportunities. Henry II installed at least 42 bishops across his 22-year reign. The practice peaked under Henry III when half of all bishops emerged from the chapel. Capacity expanded with the foundation in 1050 as an additional training school of the St. Simon and St. Jude Monastery at the Royal Palace in Goslar, Lower Saxony. Connections to royalty did not automatically make bishops more reliable partners. Kinship was at least as important, with families directly related to the king providing a quarter of both senior secular lords and bishops in the 11th century. In the longer term, the monarchy was a victim of its own success. Royal patronage of the church increased the attractions of clerical appointments for lords, who began expecting appointments. The later Salians were unable, or possibly unwilling, to open the episcopate to the new class of unfree vassals called ministeriales, who emerged in the 11th century and might have provided a counterweight to aristocratic influence. The demographic and economic expansion from 950 was another factor behind royal patronage, because kings saw senior clergy as ideal agents to tap the growing resources. This explains why the later Ottonian and Salian kings accelerated the transfer of crowned lands to the imperial church and entrusted senior clergy with new secular powers like mint and market rights and jurisdiction for crime and public order. Far from representing a dissipation of central authority, this entailed the replacement of relatively inefficient direct management by a more productive partnership with the imperial church. Henry II began donating imperial abbeys to bishops whose sees overlaid duchies where royal control was weak. For example, Bishop Meinwart of Paderborn received several abbeys, strengthening him relative to the powerful Duke of Saxony. The bishops of Metz, Toul, and Verdun were likewise patronized as counterweights to the Duke of Upper Lorraine. Italian bishops had already acquired county jurisdictions by the early 10th century, and this was extended by Henry II to Germany, where 54 counties had transferred into episcopal hands by 1056. This explains why the early Salians saw no danger in the cause of church liberty emerging from 11th century reform, since it appeared to free valuable assets from the influence of potentially difficult secular lords. Bishops also welcomed the greater powers that assisted their conscription of peasant labor and the resources needed for cathedral construction. The invention of new techniques like frame construction increased the scale of both buildings and clerical ambitions. Within 4 days of arriving in Paderborn in 1009, Meinwart ordered the half-finished cathedral to be demolished and resumed on a grander scale. Meanwhile, his colleague in Mainz embarked on a lavish construction program to underpin his claim as Germany's senior churchman. Bishops also adopted the new royal symbolism that had been introduced by Otto II by representing themselves in sculpture and pictures as seated on thrones. Episcopal and royal splendor were still mutually reinforcing at this point, and kings participated fully in the building boom. Henry III dramatically expanded Speyer Cathedral, making it the largest religious building north of the Alps in the mid-11th century, and setting aside 189 square meters of the nave for the royal tomb. The symmetry of royal and ecclesiastical power was symbolized by the addition of two towers of equal height and a throne room above the western portico from where the emperor could see the mass. These modifications were replicated in many other cathedrals. Relations were not always so harmonious, even before the investiture dispute beginning in the 1070s. The most notorious case involved the rivalry of Archbishop Anno II of Cologne, Archbishop Adalbert of Hamburg-Bremen, and Bishop Heinrich II of Augsburg during the regency for Henry IV, 1056-1065, and underscores the importance of personalities in imperial politics. Anno wanted to assert his own exclusive control and persuaded the young king to inspect a boat moored outside the royal palace at Kaiserwerth on an island in the Rhine on the 31st of March, 1062. No sooner was the king aboard than Anno's co-conspirators cast off. Henry tried to escape by jumping overboard, but was fished out by Count Egbert of Brunswick, and the boat sailed to Cologne, allegedly for the king's safety. Secular lords did not always cooperate with imperial bishops, as illustrated in the defeat of Adalbert's plans to revive Hamburg-Bremen's earlier role as sole archbishopric for the Baltic and Scandinavia. He used his influence in the regency to acquire additional benefices and planned to incorporate 12 North German bishoprics within his jurisdiction. The Saxon lords compelled Henry IV to oblige Adalbert to relinquish two-thirds of his assets to their two leaders in 1066. The significance of Adalbert's alienation of secular support was revealed later that year by the largest Slav rising since 983. Antagonized by Adalbert's missionary zeal, the pagan Wends burned Hamburg and Schleswig, stoned Christians in Ratzeburg, and murdered one of their own princes who had cooperated. The Imperial Church after the investiture dispute. The investiture dispute changed how the church related to the emperor, but it did not diminish the church's political role. The reemergence of the monk-bishop ideal challenged political appointments, but it made little difference, as the aristocracy retained the best access to education and continued to dominate senior church positions. The Worms Concordat of 1122 confirmed that local clergy and laity were to participate in selecting their bishop. In practice, the wider population was excluded by the 12th century through the emergence of cathedral and abbey chapters composed of lay canons, or senior clergy who had not taken full vows and who managed their church's secular affairs. The royal chapel lost much of its political significance, since the way to become a bishop now lay through winning influence in the relevant chapter. This contrasted with the situation in France, where the king had displaced the chapter's role in selection by the later Middle Ages. Although the Worms Concordat allowed the king to be present at elections, it was scarcely possible to coordinate royal movements with the death and succession of individual bishops. Conrad III's presence is documented for only 8 of the 36 episcopal elections during his reign, while Frederick I Barbarossa was present at just 18 of the 94 elections under his kingship. Nonetheless, monarchs retained considerable influence, sending envoys to express their views and, less directly, through their ability to favor clients with appointments as canons. They were aided by the generational shift around 1140, as the imperial church passed into the hands of men who had not participated in the investiture dispute and who viewed royal influence more pragmatically. This explains why the transfer of secular jurisdictions to the imperial church resumed with even greater force under the Staufers, who enfeoffed favored bishops with not merely counties, but also ducal powers after 1168. The new relationship was codified in a general charter favoring what were now explicitly called ecclesiastical princes, which was issued in April 1220. This consolidated church lands as a distinct category of imperial fief held by senior clerics elected by their abbey or cathedral chapter. Like their hereditary secular counterparts, ecclesiastical lords only exercised their privileges once the emperor confirmed them in office. Their secular authority rested on the clutch of jurisdictions and material assets acquired over time and now permanently associated with their abbey or diocese. These jurisdictions were extensive, collectively covering a third of the German kingdom, but they remained fiefs held immediately under the emperor's authority and entailed obligations to support him with advice, troops, and other assistance. Simultaneously, the ecclesiastical lords exercised spiritual jurisdictions that generally extended far beyond their own lands and across neighboring fiefs held by hereditary secular lords. These spiritual jurisdictions were bolstered by the ongoing incorporation of parishes within diocesan control and included powers to supervise local clergy and religious practice. Abbots and bishops participated in the general trend to territorialize rights through clearer, more exclusive demarcation of jurisdictions underway from the 13th century. However, unlike their secular counterparts, they suffered from the Staufer's demise around 1250, because the persistence of weaker monarchs into the 14th century reduced the flow of patronage and benefices. Abbeys with nuns were especially hard hit, with many disappearing during the 12th and 13th centuries through incorporation within the domains of their secular protectors. Many abbeys and bishoprics now appeared under-resourced compared to the larger secular fiefs. Secular lords tried to curtail spiritual jurisdiction where this conflicted with their own powers to adjudicate criminal behavior, especially as the growing significance on personal piety and morality from the 13th century changed how many misdemeanors were perceived. Ecclesiastical lords frequently lost lands that they had previously pawned to secular neighbors to avoid insolvency. Some ecclesiastical lords agreed treaties of protection, whereby secular lords assumed various functions on their behalf, including honoring their obligations as imperial vassals. Over time, such agreements eroded the ecclesiastical lords' immediacy, and by the later 15th century, 15 bishoprics, including Brandenburg and Meissen, were well on their way to being fully incorporated within secular principalities.